This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, and this is the audio version of a video live stream that takes place every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Before I get to today's most excellent episode, I want to tell you about a brand new Reason podcast series. It's a limited series that's got 6 episodes, and the first one's already out. It's called Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and it's hosted by the great Reason writer Eric Boehm, who explains how dumb trade policy makes everything from baby formula to underwear more expensive. Subscribe at reason.com/podcasts or wherever you get your shows. So on to today's Reason interview. The guest this week was actor and filmmaker Alex Winter, who you'll recall from movies like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and The Lost Boys and a host of others. He has been making great documentary films for well over a decade. His most recent movie is The YouTube Effect, an in-depth look at the ways in which that video site has radically altered how we produce and consume politics, culture, and ideas. In past documentaries, Alex investigated things like Napster and its users. He told the story of Ross Ulbricht, the creator of the Silk Road Deep Web site, and he profiled most recently the life and legacy of rock musician and free expression activist Frank Zappa. In this new movie, The YouTube Effect, he traces the rise of YouTube from its launch in 2005 to its contemporary status as the second most visited website on the planet, behind only its corporate owner, Google. My co-host for this interview, for this live stream, was Zach Weismuller, who, like me, has talked to Alex over the years about his documentary, and we talk with him about his concerns about how YouTube is helping along the polarization of politics and of society in America. He's very concerned about disinformation in ways that we don't really necessarily agree with. This is a lively and spirited conversation about the future of free speech and creative expression online. Here is the Reason interview with Alex Winter. Alex, it's good to talk to you again.
It's always good to talk to both of you.
We have been, you have been directing for about 30 years, right? Didn't your first feature movie, I believe, came out in 1993 that you directed and starred in?
Yeah, though I think it's scary to say my first professional directing job started in the mid 80s. So it's getting close to 40, which, okay. So maybe let's just stick with 30.
Yeah,
30 okay. sounds well, a lot less scary.
Yeah, it's, but in any case, you have done documentaries in particular over the past 15, 20 years, Downloaded, which was a great study of Napster and unauthorized file sharing. The Deep Web, a look at Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road. Trust Machine, the Panama Papers. And then I think most recently was Zappa, which came out about 3 years ago, about Frank Zappa as a kind of ultra-individualist, free speech activist, technological savant, etc. We are now talking about The YouTube Effect, your new movie that's out. Zach, let's play the trailer, and then we're going to come back and talk with Alex about what's in the movie.
Web giant Google will pay $1.6 billion to gobble up YouTube.
The making of YouTube.
Here's your new key to the new office.
There was no doubt in my mind that this was going to be a huge trend of the future.
YouTube celebrities are laughing along with their fans all the way to the bank.
This kid, Ryan, who earned $22 million this year.
They want growth, growth, growth. Everything's about growth.
Go hit that like button.
They are obligated to maximize shareholder value.
Ad money, that really affects the kind of content that you can make.
Their lust for hijacking people's attention.
You just have to get eyes on the video.
Everything on YouTube changed when the recommender algorithm was introduced.
It's not just algorithmic, it's very deliberate.
I'm a weapon. I'm made to be thrown at you.
I think YouTube is a very intimate format. You're watching one person talk to you.
When they start telling you about their beliefs and views, that pack a real punch.
Now we're in this sort of misinformation apocalypse.
I don't agree that it is just a reflection of society. It's changed society.
This is just made up by Bill Gates and them. Go online and look it up.
It's kind of dangerous how we are just waiting for there to be enough of these digital car crashes in this digital intersection with no stoplight.
if we don't figure out this problem, we're going to lose what it means to be human.
All right, that's the trailer. The movie is playing in select theaters around the country, around the world, and it's going on streaming services, so you can watch it. I highly recommend that you do. But Alex, as a starting point, what is the YouTube effect, or what are the effects in particular that you're trying to bring attention to in the documentary?
I think it's the societal impact. I think that when I was digging around in this community, which is now by far the largest online community on the planet by a lot bigger than anything that's in its rearview mirror, I felt that there wasn't really a lot of examination on Google and its media platform, YouTube, which is what YouTube is. It's really Google's media front end. And I felt as if the societal impact of that platform, now that it's been around long enough and it's so big and pervasive globally, was really beginning to attempt to unpack that, to have a very close look at that. And Gail Ann Hurd, the producer, had come to me and asked me if I was interested in collaborating with her on the story. She had some access. She knew I would have access. And it had obviously been on my mind for quite some time. It had been on my mind for probably a solid decade in terms of its significance and its impact. So it felt like a good time to jump in.
Yeah. What, you know, can you just very quickly sketch the... well, actually, Zach, why don't you run through some of the numbers?
Yeah. Because
it's fascinating to think about. You know, when you said, oh, I've been directing movies for 40 years, it's like, I remember a time before I had a computer. I realize I'm like, you know, a mammoth, or I guess a mastodon these days, like a dying breed. But the just to think about the world before YouTube is like a radically different place. Zach, I'm sorry, run through the reach of this?
Yeah, you mentioned its tremendous growth. This is the first kind of slide that appears in your movie. You mentioned December 2005, YouTube officially launches to over 2 million video views per day. A month later, that reaches 25 million views. Today, it has over 2.6 billion users worldwide. It's the second most visited website by traffic in the world as of June 2023, right behind Google. You described it as the front end of Google. So in a way, Google's got the one and two spots there. It is the second most popular social network worldwide, right behind Facebook. Facebook at 2.9 billion users, YouTube, as we mentioned, a little over 2.5 billion users. And this data here is from kind of one of their recent internal reports put together by Oxford Economics that looks at the economic impact of YouTube. And according to their internal report here, their creative ecosystem has contributed over $35 billion to US GDP in 2022. That's not counting kind of YouTube's parent company. That's just the platform, the creators. And then YouTube's creative ecosystem has supported, they claim, more than 390,000 full-time equivalent jobs in the US. So, you know, given that meteoric rise, that explosive growth, first of all, what do you think explains that? Why did YouTube grow so quickly out of the gate?
I think there's a number of things at play. And I think some of those are actually good things. And I think to credit Susan Wojcicki all the way back in the day, because she wasn't obviously just the CEO of YouTube, which she isn't now. She was when we made the film. She's stepped down subsequently. But she was also an instrumental part of the formulation of Google itself, and a big part of how Google rose. And very, very smart, and very forward-thinking. And I think that Susan saw in this fledgling little video platform what a lot of other people didn't, which was, to a degree, the future. You know, we'd had Napster. A sense by then that the world was moving online and that media was moving online. And I think it was obvious to people like me on Napster in 1998, 1999. So it would certainly have been obvious to anyone inside Silicon Valley if it wasn't obvious to most folks elsewhere. And I think what Susan saw, and then what she subsequently had a hand in building with Steve Chen and Chad Hurley, who were the two of the three founders of YouTube and then went on to run it for a while, was that this wouldn't just be a Facebook. It wouldn't just be a kind of a video jukebox, of which there were many back in those days. If you know, like Nick and I are old, so we remember totally what it was like to.
I still miss Audio Galaxy. I'm not going to lie.
There you go. Exactly. You know? And Winamp. I'm going to go. So there was a lot of these things floating around, but nobody in those days, the winners of the tech space were going to be those who figured out how to put their arms around most of these tools and then make them very easy for users to navigate and use, which is what YouTube was. So I think there was an understanding that it could become a video platform for users to upload their own stuff, a social media community, which is a component of that, a place for entertainment, for visual and audio entertainment, a place for creators that would then be monetized because they started monetizing their creators very early. Smosh, who were two of the first creators, the Fine Brothers, early on began to monetize almost immediately in significant ways. They were built, all four of these guys were teenagers practically and began to earn a very good living. So I think that the vision for it was there. And I think that the willingness to create an infrastructure that would equitably and fairly pay content creators all over the world, right, of every color, of every ethnicity, of every type of gender, it was really radical what they set out to do in that way. And what it has grown into now is by far the largest media platform on the planet.
Yeah, I think it would be useful, especially for some of our younger viewers who might not remember those earliest days of YouTube, to just glimpse back at a second as to what it used to look like. It was very, before monetization and professionalization, it was very much just like your amateurs uploading just a dumb video you took. And kind of we can just look at the very first video that was put up. That one of the founders kind of set the tone for early YouTube. This is a video called Me at the Zoo.
One of the elephants. Cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long trunks. And that's cool. And that's pretty much all there is to say.
No disinformation there. That is an absolute truth. Elephants do have long trunks.
Absolutely. That's got, I think, a couple hundred million views racked up by now. But, we wanted to talk about, before we get into some of the negatives that your documentary raises, could you talk a little bit about YouTube's upsides? What are some of the best contributions to, our culture, to video and filmmaking that you think YouTube has made over the years?
There are so many, and Google as well. And I sort of mention them in the same breath because they really are one company, even though there are elements to YouTube that are separate. They are really one company with a single ethos. And I'd say the positives of that are a commitment to innovation and kind of human evolution using the culture itself as its primary product. And I think a lot of that has been extremely vitally important to global culture. In such vast ways that it's almost diminishes its power to start to break apart little things like, oh, it's helpful to figure out how to put AAA batteries into the back of your radio. It's like, it gives you like mundane information. Well, it's also the repository of basically all of visual human content that's ever existed since the dawn of content being recorded in any form and even not recorded, but re-implemented in some form or another by the way of explainers. So it is our library, Alexandria. I know that's a terrifying concept, especially to librarians, because there is so much misinformation there,
there was a lot of information in the Library of Alexandria too, right?
Lot of misinformation in your local public library. So that's sort of my point, is where I get kind of, disconcerted by the way we look at the rise of new technology, having been around these stories for a long time, is we other it, right? It's this other thing, but it's not another thing. It's really a natural evolution of human innovation. And these are tools that we have evolved to create, and they're just a part of the fabric of being human. So YouTube specifically, I would credit them with, as I said earlier, with very specifically and intentionally monetizing the democratization of culture, something that we saw happening with Napster that the record industry, I would argue, still has not successfully done as well as YouTube has done. I would even argue that my industry, which is on strike right now, has not figured it out as well as YouTube has. You can create on YouTube. You can be a trans, you know, African artist in a micro nation and make a crazy good living if you have access to these tools and can, you will get monetized, you'll build an audience, the gates are down, you're reaching people all over the world. And so that's an amazing thing that I think they did intentionally and very successfully. I think the breadth of information is vitally important to have at the fingertips of anyone around the world. It just removes gatekeeping and it removes, it democratizizes information, unless you're in China where they can literally censor you.
Right. And I mean, just to kind of build on that, one of the early sensations on YouTube was watching Chinese kids lip syncing to the Backstreet Boys songs and things like that. And it created
Gangnam Style, the rise of K-pop.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have had
that. I mean, it created a global village, right, that Marshall McLuhan could only kind of speculate about in the 60s. And it built off of those signal developments in the 90s that were, a lot of it was around the internet, but it was other, just the decreasing price of technology so that, the cost to produce and consume culture under whatever circumstances you wanted, whether it was authorized, unauthorized, legal, illegal, all became much cheaper. I just, part of the upside for us at Reason was we went online with Reason TV, as it was called, in October 2007. We've been on YouTube since 2007, and we've had something like 255 million views of our over 3,000 videos that we've put up. We've only made about $500,000 all told, so it's not like we're making a living out of it, but it's better than zero. But that idea that you can bring together information shared and distributed, and it might find a global market, is humongous. One of the kind of examples in this, it seemed like it wasn't that long ago, but it actually was kind of, but Kony 2012 is an example of a documentary, which there's a lot of reasons to be, critical of it, but it was about a warlord in Africa who had a child army. That became a massive global phenomenon in 2012. And it kind of shows the power of YouTube to kind of galvanize people in ways good and bad. And you touch on this, the YouTube, one of the most popular things on it are explainer videos and how-to videos, and that has gone massively large. But let's talk a little bit about the negative sides that you roll out about YouTube in this, because this documentary is not really a celebration of YouTube as much as a critique of it. So, Zach, do you want to talk about...
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should start talking about the rabbit hole problem. This gentleman who I brought a slide up of is Caleb. He posted a video here called My Descent into the Alt-Right Pipeline. He's a major character featured in your documentary. What does Caleb's story exemplify for you?
Well, it actually exemplifies that we're beyond the rabbit hole, that there was a period when the YouTube recommender algorithm was aggressively propagandizing viewers because you could go on, if you had a predilection to look at, an influencer that had a certain type of rhetoric that was fairly benign, you could very quickly get recommended much more extreme influencers and content that would, as the term illustrates, would take you down a rabbit hole. It's very difficult to get rabbit hole today. They did, in fairness to YouTube, do a lot of work on that algorithm. In fact, with Caleb, kind of as a test case, we didn't put this in the film because it was pointless, but when I filmed him, which was at the Watergate Hotel, because we're cheeky like that, we did a test with him where I had him go on his laptop and try to rabbit hole himself, and he couldn't. The algorithm just wasn't going to do that to him. And so the reason I was interested in Caleb was Caleb, was already on his way towards extremist views. And YouTube and the influencers that they had on there at the time, which were very aggressively extremist, like Stefan Molyneux, who was a big part of the influence of the shooter in the Christchurch, New Zealand shooting, was heavily influenced by Stefan, and that got Stefan deplatformed eventually. But it was really about where we are post this rabbit hole idea, the whole idea that misinformation is so proliferate the monetization of propaganda is so proliferate now in our current culture that we're almost all being rabbit hole, or we're almost all sort of in a blasé way accepting of misinfo or flat out disinfo. And in Caleb's case, he was kind of pulled out of that extremist thinking by another person on YouTube, which was Natalie Wynn, which we used to kind of prove a point that, you know, the some of the harms are here, but a lot of the antidote for those harms can be found in the same place, can be found in YouTube itself.
Yeah. At one point, you actually quote Caleb as saying, I wasn't radicalized by YouTube. I was already radicalized. But he was talking about that the videos that he was watching killed his empathy. But then he comes across ContraPoints, as she is better known. And it's kind of fascinating that, you know, to see YouTube is not, you know, an engine of disaster, or to the extent that it is, it also becomes an agent of empathy as well.
Exactly. I think that that's really exemplifies the internet itself. It's the whole spectrum of human experience. The issues to focus on the harms and what I wanted to get at in the film was, A, I wanted to put a human face on all of these issues, because I think that's important. And that's what docs are very good at. You can read a million articles about YouTube and about social media and see a million documentaries that don't really humanize a core cast of characters that give you an emotional understanding of the issues at play. And so from the people who actually experienced it, not like actors or reenactments or something. So that was very important to me. But I also wanted to get past this idea of the algorithm, which in my opinion is kind of a diversion tactic by these monopolized tech companies to just flood you with confusing tech rhetoric that just makes the average person's eyes glaze over. And then you never get into the details of how you can maybe make these places work better. And yes, there are algorithms. And yes, there are a lot of engineers who need to be working on algorithms. But most of us are not tech engineers. Most of us are, including the people who run Google and YouTube, are just people with basic incentives. And it was these basic incentives that I was most interested in focusing on with this film, which in this case is their business model, which is an ad revenue based business model, which is attaches a dollar to content that holds you on platform. And to them, just like the yellow journalists of yesteryear, as we all know, the most salacious type of content is normally the most ad friendly. And that is the case with YouTube in a way that I think is problematic.
So you mentioned that now things have changed, and you even tried to get Caleb to rabbit hole himself and could not. Does that indicate to you that something has shifted in the incentives? Is it that the advertisers started to get uncomfortable with the kind of press that YouTube was getting, and therefore they decided to shift the algorithm? I mean, how did the business model work to sort of correct itself in this case?
It's the opposite. It's the opposite of it getting better, of there being less harmful information, of advertisers getting wary. What it was that they don't need to rabbit hole you to get you to watch salacious content. Disinformation is now pervasive, right? I mean, I have friends who are on all sides of the political aisle who flirt with extremely bananas theories of either flat earth or just very cockamamie ideas about the world that are not fact-based. The sort of non-fact-based culture is pervasive. So you don't need, the incentives aren't there to force you algorithmically into this kind, towards this kind of content. As Joe Pulitzer knew in the late 1800s, it's just human nature, right? You are pre-wired to connect more intensely with hyperbolic, angry, negative content than you are with middle of the road, fact-based content. So they don't need to do that. It's really a human issue. It's the parasocial relationship of having someone looking into a webcam, like I'm looking at you guys and you're looking back at me. It's that very human, non-algorithmic, parasocial component that makes YouTube so powerful. And when you attach that to content, then you can monetize.
Yeah, when you say it's you know, negative or, you know, and hyperbolic and things like that, how does that explain, you know, the emergence of somebody like Mr. Beast on YouTube, who's one of the largest, you know, channels and characters? And it's, if anything, it's relentlessly upbeat. It's like Barney the Dinosaur, you know, post going through puberty or something like that. Is it actually, is it negative, like salacious, negative, hyperbolic? Is that the, is that how they keep people watching, or is it more catering to what people are interested in?
I think it's both. I think that when you deal with media, a media platform as big as YouTube, of which there is no larger media platform,
right,
you're going to be targeting massively disparate demographics. Mr. Beast, for instance, my middle school kid loves Mr. Beast, and all of his friends in middle school love Mr. Beast, but I've never watched a single Mr. Beast video in my entire life, and neither have my two older children. Not one, not a single one. So you're just talking about demographics. And I think that's where it's a business model problem, because to advertisers are looking at a pie chart of numbers, and they're not differentiating at all between Mr. Beast and Steven Crowder, right? But of course, there is a difference between Mr. Beast and Steven Crowder, because Mr. Beast is like doing these kind of benign, you know, whatever, come and earn $1 million by jumping off this bridge. And Steven Crowder is calling for civil war after the FBI goes down to Mar-a-Lago to look at Trump's classified documents. And to an advertiser, it's just data points. It's the same.
Can I, before Zach has a clip that he's going to run, but just before we move on from the question of misinformation or disinformation, I agree with you absolutely that most of my friends believe things that are insane and not fact-based. Sometimes they get support from books. Sometimes they get support, you know, from videos, or, you know, maybe even from Reason articles or something like that. But how do you define that? In a way that doesn't just become, I don't agree with this, and hence it is disinformation, or it's misinformation, or it's malinformation, and needs to be called out.
There are very clear-cut definitions to the difference between misinformation and disinformation that are generally used. Misinformation essentially refers to information that is untrue but may be benign. It may be an accidental mistake. It may be a fact that is incorrect. Disinformation is ideologically manufactured to with an agenda. So it is not so much that, this is where I think it gets misconstrued by the public, or when we get into, like, I would argue, kind of misunderstanding the First Amendment or free speech issues. Disinformation is intentionally targeted information that is literally ideologically manufactured to create a response. It is actually propaganda. And a lot of the dark money funded influencers on YouTube that are pumping out disinformation have very specific political ideologies that they are servicing. So it isn't accidental, and it isn't something that ends up getting contextualized by the end user. It is created intentionally for X effect. I think the Crowder example is a good one. I think that inciting your 4 million viewers to civil war, based on a completely legal and fairly casual visit to our ex-president by an FBI member based on classified information, which is no different than they would do to a Democratic president or a different Republican member, that is a very good example of disinformation that's harmful.
To return to the ContraPoints Natalie Wynn example for a second, because what I find really interesting about that channel and about what Natalie is doing there is, she's kind of embracing this landscape that you're describing, or just like, this is, she's just accepting, like, this is the water we're swimming in. It's a very personal medium. And she just directly engages with the culture war arguments, dissects the dishonest rhetoric, and kind of jumps into the arena instead of sitting on the sideline begging YouTube to deplatform or demonetize people. And does it in a very stylized way, as we can see here. This is kind of the aesthetic established that's designed to maximize engagement, kind of do what you need to do on YouTube to reach an audience and reach outside of an echo chamber and build a following. And in this case, there's evidence that that approach is an effective tactic. What is your takeaway from what the ContraPoints channel has done?
My takeaway is, and I think this is Natalie's having spoken to her about it, is that you work with the tools you have. So I think when you have something that has YouTube has 4.6 or 4.7 billion video views per day. So there's a lot of people who don't have the tools at Natalie's disposal. Natalie's working with what Natalie has to be involved. I know that Natalie, that ContraPoints is very supportive of civic engagement and civic response. So, you know, she has been able to build up a massive audience on YouTube, which is extremely rare, I would also add. So there, it is not by any means the only tool that people should be using. Carrie Goldberg is using the tools at her disposal as a lawyer to literally create lawsuits and go after for very specific harms based on very specific issues on platform. So I think it's incumbent. I mean, my general opinion is it's all hands on deck. I think that because, and to be fair to Google, including Google's hands on deck, right? And including fixes from within their own company, which are basic. I just think that we've never seen in human history a company, this industrial revolution, the digital technological industrial revolution that we're currently in, has moved at an accelerated pace, the likes of which we've never seen. So we're all playing catch up a little bit.
And the, you know, YouTube's CEO, or I guess outgoing CEO, Susan Wojcicki, last year was talking on all this very topic in Davos at the World Economic Forum in 2022. I want to play a clip from that just to get so everyone can get a sense of how YouTube is thinking about this, you know, from the top, and then get your reaction to the proposals that are being laid out there.
Investing a huge amount to make sure that we're fighting misinformation. And there are a number of different ways that we look at this. So the first would be from a policy standpoint, we would look at content that we would think about in terms of being violative of our policies. So if you look at COVID, for example, we came up with 10 different policies that we said would be violative. Like an example of that would be saying that COVID came from something other than a virus. And we did see people attacking 5G equipment, for example, because they thought that it was causing COVID. And the second one would be really raising up authoritative information. So if you are dealing with a sensitive subject like news, health, science, we are gonna make sure that what we're recommending is coming from a trusted, well-known publisher that can be reliable. If there's content that's borderline content that technically meets our policy but is lower quality, that's content that we basically will not recommend to our users. Our users could still access it. And then lastly, we're just really careful about what we monetize. So we always want to make sure that there's no incentive. So for example, with regard to climate change, we don't monetize any kind of climate change material. So there's no incentive for you to keep publishing that material that is propagating something that is generally understood as not accurate information.
So taking down really blatant misinformation, like that 5G towers are causing COVID-19, you know, deranking certain sources, upranking authoritative sources, and then demonetizing controversial debates that she believes are spreading misinformation. Is that an agenda that you think is a positive one for YouTube to be pursuing?
I think it would be great to see them do that.
Mm-hmm. So they're not doing it.
No, they're not doing that.
But here's my reaction to that, because I do think it's totally understandable and appropriate for a company like YouTube to not want videos about 5G conspiracies running rampant on a platform.
I don't agree with that, though. That's not true. They're actually incentivized to have a lot of material like that. In fact, Google came under fire over the last few weeks in terms of how it's spending their ad dollars and not spending them in areas that they told their advertisers they were spending them. So no, I would actually argue that while philosophically they may not like the idea that they're monetizing this type of content, they are absolutely monetizing this type of content.
But they have taken that sort of stuff.
Some of them, you can find all that stuff. All that stuff is there on YouTube. All of it is there.
The flip side to all this is that I've seen what happens when, you know, misinformation has become somewhat of a buzzword, and I've seen what happens when the net is cast too wide. I mean, even Reason TV, we got a strike for, this was a video I produced. It was about these biohackers attempting to kind of create a knockoff COVID vaccine, and was called medical misinformation. I mean, I just happen to know the fact that this was not medical misinformation. It was me reporting on something somebody was trying to do, but it got caught, and it was like 6-7 months after it went up that it got caught in this dragnet. And so that's the kind of impossible thing about regulating misinformation at scale, you know, whether you're a government or a private company. How do you cope?
I don't think that's true, though. I don't think impossible is the right word. I think that it's early days, and oftentimes, because these companies aren't incentivized to police themselves, they do it very badly. And they do it with a blunt hammer as opposed to a scalpel. And it is early. Like, because for sure, Zach, there are people who create music on YouTube who get their own content flagged. Like, really, even beyond what the example you just gave, like, really glaring.
We are constantly being accused of infringing our own copyright, for instance.
Exactly. And that happens all the time. Now, we would need 5 hours for this conversation. I will tell you, and you know how I feel about this stuff. I made the Napster movie.
Yeah.
I will tell you that using copyright and IP law in this area to try to rectify this stuff is generally disastrous, right? And I will, and so I'm not like some big, you know, let's just come down on everyone with harsher copyright law. It will generally hurt the folks that you're trying to help and help the folks that you're trying to get protection from. It's just the way those laws are constructed. So I am not sitting here saying that stuff is easy, but I will tell you that it's a heck of a lot simpler than people are making it out to be. And you have to start somewhere. So yes, a lot of the tools right now are very blunt, but they will definitely get less blunt as we go along. We certainly don't want to do nothing.
Well,
so we gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, can I ask about that? Because, you know, in a way, it seems like you want to bring back, or maybe, you know, realistically it probably has never gone away, but this idea that there's a guardian class that must control what people are exposed to, because they really can't handle things, they can't sort things out themselves. And, you know, this goes back to when the novel was introduced, when radio was introduced, movies, you know, comic books, et cetera, rock music in particular, you know, and I think about, you know, your documentary on Zappa. You know, this is redolent with, there's certain types of material which should not be permitted because it will have a negative effect on people who can't understand it or can't critique it. Is there, you know, is there a contradiction in what you're saying between, you know, your earlier work and your kind of emphasis on people being allowed to express themselves?
No, because I think we're talking about, there's an enormous, enormous spread there. And I think that if you're with disinformation being information that is specifically created to cause harm, those are basic safeguards. I don't think there's a lot of, that doesn't enter sort of free speech territory. You know, if someone's being called upon to go kill trans people and someone goes and kills a trans person. No, I think it, you know,
well, there's fighting words and true threats that are, you know, have been worked through.
Yeah.
The court,
and there's
right?
a lot
but,
of
I mean,
studies
does...
showing the impact of fighting words on actual fighting. And I think that is where the arguments for everything being fair game are not valid.
Like when Steven Crowder says we need a civil war because my, you know, God, you know, boy, God, Trump is being investigated by the FBI, that crosses a line, that if somebody's saying, you know what, we need a total reordering of society based on recent political events, that would be.
Sure. Okay. I mean, it's also intentionally being done and funded by dark money interests that are trying to create these harms and this violence. You know, as we saw with the Trump indictment from yesterday, the intention with the January 6th insurrection was to kill the enemy. It was actually to commit that violence. More people were radicalized to go to the January 6th insurrection by YouTube than any other internet-based platform. That is a study with actual numbers attached to it. So you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I'm not convinced of that. I mean, January 6th was organized in, you know, WhatsApp groups, Facebook groups. I mean, private, you know, encrypted communications, the people who showed up.
But the proliferation of the ideology was proliferated by YouTube. I mean, the Bellicam study is very comprehensive.
You know, there's near the end of the film, you start introducing some possible policy prescriptions. You bring up the famous internet law, or, you know, kind of bedrock internet law, Section 230 of the Communications and Decency Act. And that is essentially says that platforms are not liable for user-generated content on their platforms, you know, whether or not they moderate or don't moderate. Just, you know, getting involved with moderation does not mean you're suddenly liable for every single thing that someone posts on your platform. This has been something that's been attacked by both Democrats and Republicans, and your film seems to also call for some sort of reform needed around Section 230. What is it that you would like to see changed about that fundamental law of the internet?
Actually, it doesn't. Film doesn't do that. In fact, I would argue that our general take, not that my take is that important, because we're really just trying to show all sides around this debate, but Section 230 is an incredibly difficult thing to reform. And it is really what provides the safeguards for the internet, period. And tampering with it in a blunt way would actually, as I said before, cause harm to the very people that many people would be looking to protect. And it would hyper empower the monopolies. There's a reason why certain factions in extremist sides of political thinking want to abolish 230, because it would essentially allow for an enormous amount of censorship, and it would erase enormous amounts of content from the internet that is providing very important views and giving voice to people who need voice who would not have it without 230. So my general feeling on this stuff, 230, content moderation, all of it, just to be very clear, is that none of this is easy or simple. And there is not a clearly defined way forward to, say, police the internet or regulate the internet. There isn't one. My point is that the impact of these platforms on society is inarguably huge. That some of these harms are politically motivated and funded, or just ideologically motivated and funded, and that should be called out. And that we shouldn't, as citizens, sit on the sidelines and just throw up our hands and say, well, this stuff's too complicated, we shouldn't do anything. We should start to look at what we can do, however that looks. I'm not convinced that's by reforming 230 personally, but I'm not the head of ethics at Berkeley like Hani Farid is, right? Who does believe there's a way you should ask Hani, right?
So how do you look at the revelations of things like the Twitter files and Reason got a cache of documents from Facebook, where, you know, this is also something not quite new, but it became apparent that there was a huge amount of government censorship without calling it that, where, you know, people in both the Trump administration and the Biden administration, we can certainly assume, you know, George W. Bush and Obama as well, saying to platforms, hey, deprioritize that, kill this, don't push this. Does that change the complexity of the task that is at hand? That this idea that there is the private sector and the public sector, public speech, private speech, is kind of out the window now?
I think that what it does, which is good, is it shows the specificity of it, which is something we're talking about in the film, that there are ideologies at play. There are political players at play. It isn't just the town square. There are people with agendas that are funded agendas that are using this golly gee whiz parasocial influencer to say very specific things, or to attempt behind the scenes to curtail the saying of very specific things. So I actually think it's important that we understand that politics and certain players are involved in trying to shape the language or curtail the language that's out there. I think these are the beginning of conversations that we need to have. This is by no means the end of anything.
I've got a last question, because I know you've got to run in a minute. You directed another great documentary called Deep Web about the Ross Ulbricht saga. And as such, you know, I'm sure you're well aware of that encrypted communication messengers and platforms and decentralized alternatives to YouTube have taken off as well as centralized competitors like Rumble. How does that change the situation in terms of how you think about these issues of radicalization and misinformation and free speech if there really is increasingly no central node to kind of enforce any of this?
I think that there is, because I think at the end of the day, the large scale populace is mostly on the main platforms. The numbers of the platforms you just mentioned, or even Silk Road, that was my problem with the way Ross was being treated, Ross Ulbricht, in that instance, because he was being called a kingpin. And you know, even the drugs that were being sold, there were like the amount of money in that was like what you'd get on a street corner in Idaho, right? So they're actually fairly small. And I do worry about the breaking of encryption around regulation, which we're starting to see in the EU as a potential problem with the way they're coming at regulating the internet, that would also potentially destroy encryption, which would be incredibly dangerous for a lot of people who rely on encryption for their safety. So I think that I'm a big believer, as you both of you guys well know, in the innovation and the freedom of information and encryption and open source technology. But I don't see that being, nor can it be stopped, but I don't see it being stopped. I just don't think that's the primary way that the average people get their information.
Alex, what is the best way to catch the YouTube effect?
Well, we will be on digital on August 8th, so we'll really be everywhere, especially, I mean, in any English-speaking country. I think we're hitting other places internationally a little later, but you'll be able to find us on sort of your usual platforms. You can go to my website, alexwinter.com, and find us, but we will be very easy to see on August 8th. Right now, we're in select theaters.
Final question. You were talking briefly before about participatory culture, essentially, and this is, there's a long arc. Again, as the production costs and consumption costs of media become cheaper, we could look back at this for 500 years or 50 years or 10 years. Participatory culture seems to be the answer. Make the final case, like, how should people get off the sidelines in order to enter the scrum to fight for the world that they want? Is YouTube the medium for that primarily, or?
I think that, you know, and this is maybe not an intentionally provocative thing to say, but I think people need to lean into these technologies and not away from them. I think that they're a big part of our life and you have to get involved. I know my kids are safe because I'm on YouTube. I know who the good apples are and the bad. It's like, that's parenting, right? It's just like, I wouldn't send my kid into a neighborhood without knowing the neighborhood or let him be with someone that I didn't think was safe. All three of my kids have been on YouTube their entire life. Not one of them got like black-pilled or red-pilled or whatever it is right. The kids say. It's, you know, I think leaning in, I think having an awareness that these technologies are not necessarily good or bad. They are just a part of human evolution and innovation. So be part of them, use them, understand them, be discerning. So I think that their participation can come from wherever, like you were saying about ContraPoints, it comes from wherever your strength is. And really understanding what's going on in the world in sort of a broad way.
Thank you so much, Alex Winter. The new movie is The YouTube Effect. Thanks again for talking to Reason.
Yeah, it was great. As always, you had great questions. So thanks.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up. Subscribe. We're putting out two episodes a week. You don't want to miss a single one. Or make it so easy on yourself that, of course, you'll do this. Go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. And you can check out at reason.com/podcasts Eric Boehm's great new limited podcast series, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. And you can also find the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates, our other two long-running podcast series. They're all at reason.com/podcasts. Please check them out, and thanks for listening.